Thank you very much for having Nikki and myself here. The second time we've been to Salisbury, it was a couple of years back. The contact between Nikki and Lynn and Jeff goes back even further. Nikki and Lynn were at school together, and they used to sing in a worship group called Shekinah even before I knew them. So there is a long-standing friendship there. When we come and do talks like this, then I always have to assume that there's going to be a wide range of knowledge. Some people know quite a lot about MAF quite often, other people know very little. And so if what I say tonight is old hat to you, I apologize. I can guarantee there will at least be some new pictures for you to look at, because nobody has seen some of them before except me. I also want just to try and encourage you that it's not about Nikki and myself, it's not even about MAF, and I hope that as we go through it I'll try and draw out something about it's what God is doing and what God has used us to achieve in Papua New Guinea, but it goes all around the world as well. Can I just have a quick show of hands? Who knows a reasonable amount about Mission Aviation Fellowship? So, a goodly number. Okay, right. But not everybody, that's encouraging. There we are. Just a little bit of an idea of the MAF worldview. It's actually quite an exciting time to be in MAF at the moment, because as those of you who know about MAF will be aware, it started in three different continents after the last war, in the US, in the UK and in Australia, and it spread. MAF Canada came on board as an operational group, and then there have been a lot of national groups that have developed. But traditionally MAF UK became MAF Europe, operated primarily in Africa. MAF Australia operated in its northern territories among the Aboriginal communities, where there's still a program there, and in Papua New Guinea. And MAF US operated in South America, parts of Europe, and into Indonesia and parts of Asia. But we've always done our own thing. And we're actually at the stage now where we're beginning to work together. And just a start of that was literally within the last month or so. We are, for the first time ever in our history, we've got a new image, or a new logo, which you can see up in the top right-hand corner. Although MAF Asia Pacific, which is the Australian group that we're part of, and MAF Africa are working together under MAF International now, MAF US, for various reasons, is still largely doing things itself, but even there the integration process is happening. And all of us, for the first time ever, no matter where you go in the world, you'll see the same brand, the same logo. And it might seem a fairly small thing, but these days MAF does a lot of work for international missions, international NGOs. And so in the past they could go, say, to Bangladesh and they'd see one logo. They go to Indonesia, they'd see another. They come down to Asia Pacific maybe, and at one time they would have seen yet another. But now they will know that we are actually all the same organisation. We don't just share a common name. And we feel that's quite an important thing to be part of. I'll come on a little bit later about some of the work that I'm involved in, but we are actually in the process now of beginning to work together much more closely than we ever have, and that will mean that potentially staff can also transfer between fields much more easily than has been possible in the past. There'll be the opportunity to share resources, so there'll be much better stewardship of what God gives us. So it is an exciting time. I hope the names of the countries that I've got up there is reasonably accurate and up to date. You see the second column, Liberia. That's a program that has literally just been given the go-ahead. So Liberia down the bottom left-hand side of the left-hand bump on Africa. And possibilities even of Myanmar. And Nepal they looked at a few years back, and that's just being reassessed again. We don't know whether those programs will go ahead, but certainly Liberia has been approved. The others are very much in the early stages. But exciting times. Some countries become closed as various political events change. Other countries open up. very dynamic. It's why when you read the MAF literature, where say we operate in round about 30 countries, where sometimes things will change literally overnight, there'll be a coup and people have to evacuate. Other times there'll be a change overnight and opportunities to set up a program or re-establish a previous program will come up, and so it does change. Around about 130, 135 aircraft worldwide. So we're still pretty big globally. Change. MAF's purpose is sharing God's love. It's not about flying aeroplanes. We do that through aviation. But the main purpose of what we do is to share God's love. And the vision purpose, I actually preach sermons on this, I really do get excited about this. Isolated people physically and spiritually transformed in Christ's name. That's what we're about. It's about transformation. People who are physically isolated, having their lives transformed through access to health, through access to education, through access to the gospel. I really buy into that, the physical change, but then even more so the spiritual change. Just occasionally we do get people who will ask us, well, you know, what right do you have to go in and take the gospel into these people? Why can't you leave them as they are in their wonderful state of the noble savage, which is a complete and utter myth? And I wish that I could bring some people from Papua New Guinea to answer that question to people who ask it. We're now into the second and third generation of believers in Papua New Guinea. A lot of the country didn't open up to the gospel until the 1960s and even early 1970s. But that means there are still people here who can remember the first contact with outside world, with white people. There are people still alive who can remember the first time they heard the gospel. And there are still people, therefore, alive who can remember what it was like before the transforming power of Jesus came into their lives. Fear of the dark, fear of spirits, fear of evil, fear of the witch doctor. All of that actually is still present in Papua New Guinea. Maybe if there's an opportunity, we can talk about that later on. But those who have believed in the Lord Jesus will vouch for the transforming power that it makes in their lives, in their communities. And if asked whether the early missionaries had any right to bring the gospel, they would have probably turned around and say, what right have they not to? Put it into a completely different category. But that's what we're about, and I really do get excited. Even now, we've been out there for getting on for 19 years, isolated people physically and spiritually transformed in Christ's name. I buy into that big time. A little bit about Papua New Guinea, because not many people know where it is. This is my latest foray into technology with Google Earth. So you've got Australia there, and the great big running dinosaur, the world's second largest island, is just above it. Do we have a pointer on here? Yeah. Does it show up? No, it doesn't. We'll zoom in anyway, going from space. Wrong way. Go the other way. Okay, I'll talk about why MAF is in Papua New Guinea. Where it is. Well, that's where it is. It's the eastern half of the world's second largest island. So the largest island is, anybody know the world's largest island?
Greenland.
And it's cold. Papua New Guinea isn't. We're just a little bit south of the equator and just north of Australia, as you can see. The eastern half of the island is, to give it its correct title, the independent state of Papua New Guinea. It is a democracy. Democracy does have different flavours in different parts of the world. We had a general election earlier. I don't know whether you're aware of Winston Churchill's quote about democracy, that it's the worst form of government except for all the rest. It suffers from corruption big time, unfortunately, although the present government, in all fairness to them, are, or do seem at the moment, to be beginning to try to tackle it. The western half of the island is where MAF US operates, and that's Indonesian. So if we cross the 141st meridian, which marks the border, then we're instantly into Asia. It is very, very different. Papua New Guinea, heavily influenced by Australia. It was administered by Australia up to independence in 1975, and very much a Western outlook. Whereas when you go into the Indonesian half of the island, it's very, very different. Very Asian, completely different country. Yep. So we'll zoom in a little bit. You can see the Cape York Peninsula of Australia down on the bottom, and then that's pointing straight up to Papua New Guinea. Australian territorial waters come within about a mile of the Papua New Guinean coastline at one point. And then you can begin to see the geography. There's a mountainous spine, which, if I go to a map, runs right the way down the centre of the country. And Nikki and I live up in the highlands, in a place called Mount Hagen, which is more or less the geographic centre of the country. It's a little over a mile above sea level, and the climate there during the day, it'll go up normally to the mid to upper 20s Celsius, so somewhere in the high 70s or low 80s in old currency, and then down to the high teens overnight. Just occasionally it gets really cold and goes down to about 15 Celsius. And I can remember one time we actually had to put some sweaters on, and we complained about it. And we made some comment about this to our family back home, and it was when it was minus 15 here. And they weren't sympathetic. They just couldn't understand what we were whining about. To the north and the south of the mountainous spine, great big swampy lowlands. You can be a mile from the sea, and 100 miles from the sea, and only about 50 feet above sea level. So very flat, very swampy. In the highlands, people have to walk long distances through very, very rugged terrain. Down in the lowlands, they'll do similar journeys, but in a canoe. And because the rivers are very, very tortuous, a geographer's delight in being able to show what meanders are and oxbow lakes are, it takes a long time to go places. Just as a bit of an aside to illustrate this, in an aircraft you can very often, a journey that would take maybe 3 or 4 days on foot, you can do in 15 to 20 minutes in an aircraft. But a couple of years back I went on a trip in a canoe, and it took us 14 hours to do the trip up the little tortuous river. It was an interesting trip, very uncomfortable trip, and for various reasons we decided that we weren't going to risk the river going back out, so we got some new tribes who have operator helicopter, and they came and picked us up, and they did 17 minutes instead of 14 hours. We preferred the helicopter, I have to admit. That's a view out of the office window. As you can see, it is spectacularly beautiful when you can see it, and that was taken on a particularly good day. More often in this particular area, that would all be covered with cloud, and we have to be pretty careful. But you can imagine trying to walk through that. Absolutely horrendous. In that part of the world, they normally get around about 6 metres of rain a year. So never complain that England's wet. So it's warm out there, but it is wet. Over here, it's cold and reasonably, well, they class it as a desert out there, probably, with the amount of rain that we get here. So very, very rugged. Seasons, we get 2 seasons in the highlands, a wet season and an even wetter season. And parts of the country are in rain shadow, so there's a lot of local variation. Very rugged, very beautiful, and very difficult to travel through. You can see there that just the ravines, there's in the ravine that runs from sort of bottom left up to top right is a river called the Lai River. And some years back, Nikki and I went and visited some friends, and we walked down to this river. It was when my youngest son, Philip, was quite little, and there was a vine bridge going across this ravine. And we got to that, and we said, no. And Philip was saying, please, can I go? Can I go? And we said, no. But very, very difficult to walk through, even the flat bits. And just again, a story, there was a lady in a community not far from there who was heavily pregnant, and she was concerned that she hadn't given birth. So she decided to walk to the nearest hospital, which would probably, in a straight line, be something around about 15 miles. Now, most pregnant ladies don't want to walk 15 miles, but for her it meant going up a very steep mountain, down the other side, along, down the side of this ravine, across the Vine Bridge, up the other side, and that going up was probably one of the hardest climbs I've ever done because it was slippery, and then round about another 8 to 10 kilometres along reasonable flat. She got to the end, gave birth normally and took her baby and went home. The doctor at the time, who was Australian, said that he would never have any sympathy for a woman who couldn't walk from the car into the delivery suite. Well, there's a lot of rain. There tends to be a lot of waterfalls. There are two particularly spectacular ones, and this is one of them, probably the largest, most spectacular waterfall in the country, called the Wasi Falls. Really quite dramatic. That goes down. This is the lowlands, and you can see a lot of water and flat to the horizon. And that goes out to the coast. Deserted tropical beaches, the sea temperature around about 30 degrees C most of the year round. When the boys, we've got four boys, they're all grown up and left now, but when they were with us in the country, we used to take our holidays down on the coast, and we used to have to suffer places like this. Life is tough sometimes. But no, it is very, very pretty out there, and it would be a wonderful tourist place if some of the economic and social issues in the country didn't prevent it. The people, enormously varied, as you would expect in a country that's geographically varied. This particular person, his name is Keane, and I trekked into an airstrip that had been closed for quite a few years, and I went in with a doctor who you'll see his picture a little bit later on, and I had my camera around my neck, so I was being fairly protective as I got up to a river with slippery rocks on, in it. I've been fairly precious about not slipping and getting my camera wet, and Keen just saw me messing around and he just came up behind me, picked me up and carried me across. Now, I'm not huge, but I don't weigh nothing. And this is just typical of these guys. They'll be walking along very, very slippery, muddy paths, bare feet, and they'll come up to a chasm, and I mean a chasm, where it just drops down to a raging stream down the bottom, and it's got one wet, slippery log going across it. And I come up to these things and I freeze. I'm a pilot, but I don't actually have a very good head for height when I'm actually on the ground. I'm fine in an aeroplane, that's another world, but when it's actually looking down at it and I've got to walk across, that's a completely different thing. These guys will just come up to it and they won't even break stride, straight across. And then they see there's me, a quivering mass on the other side, and they come back and, come on, I'll hold you. See me across. Very, very strong, very stocky, powerful people in the Highlands. Down in the lowlands, they are much more finely boned. They're still Melanesian, that's the people group throughout the whole of the island. And then out into the coastal areas, you get much more of what's called a Micronesian and even Polynesian influence. You can see the slightly almond eyes. And down on the coast, you also get more of a white influence sometimes, where people from Europe used to come and they'd settle and have local wife or wives, and add to the local gene pool as well. So very, very varied, very diverse. 860 different languages. So when I fly, actually, the surprise is not so much the number of languages, but more that there are people in some of these places anyway, because the country is so rugged, so hard to get to, and yet there's a village. And yet, for them, international relations starts at the mountain ridge that divides them from the neighbouring community. And they are historically very territorial, very aggressive. Tribal warfare is still a big problem in a lot of the Highlands in particular. And so that still goes on even today. Unfortunately, the relatively straightforward spats that they used to have with bows and arrows and spears have been replaced by guerrilla warfare with high-powered weaponry, which is smuggled in usually for drugs going out. So tribal warfare is a lot nastier than it even used to be. 860 different languages thereabouts. Wycliffe Bible translators obviously have a big presence in the country. I'm not sure of the total. I think it's around about 250 New Testaments, and I think it's still less than 20 complete Bibles. Way to go. So that's why SIL, Summer Institute for Linguistics, or Wycliffe Bible Translators have such a big presence there. And we do work with them quite a lot. They've got their own aviation organisation, but there are times when we actually work with them and fly for them. The boys' toys. They say that men never grow up, their toys just get more expensive. Well, these are my toys. I normally fly the one in the top left, the Cessna 206, and more particularly the one in the bottom right, the Twin Otter. And we're gradually trying to replace the old Cessna 206s with the newer Australian-built Airvan on the top right. We've got a couple of Cessna 208 caravans. They've been used very widely, very successfully throughout the MAF world. Don't fit terribly easily into our operation there because the airstrips are so challenging, and I'll show you a couple of pictures of the sorts of places that we go to, and caravans tend to require somewhere a little bit longer. But the Twin Otter down the bottom right can land anywhere that one of the little aeroplanes can. It's absolutely a remarkable bush aeroplane. We carry 20 passengers up to about 1.75 tons over short distances, so very, very good short haul aircraft. And it's got two engines, which is nice. If one stops working, I don't sweat so much. You know, those things that turn are only there to keep the pilots cool. Right? You should see them sweat if it stops. Yeah. That is an airstrip, one of the ones we go to. That's actually one of the flatter ones. And that one's getting on for 600 metres, so it's actually one of our longer ones as well. Our shortest one is 325 metres, but as it's got a 14% slope on it, we still stop quickly. If you ever want to find out how steep a 14% slope is, then go to one of these roads that's got the signpost there and try running up it. Other ones, just literally carved off the ridges. And the amount of work that goes into building these airstrips is absolutely phenomenal. But one issue that we're facing is that most of the airstrips were built around about 30 years ago now by missionaries. Now, missionaries generally have a reasonable idea about construction and airstrip maintenance, whereas the local people don't. And throughout Papua New Guinea now, there are very few expat missionaries, and the consequence is that these airstrips are getting into really quite a bad state, and they cause us a lot of grief, and it's really quite a challenge to operate in this environment now, and we're having to look at ways of how we can work with communities to improve the airstrip standard. But I've said that weather and terrain is a risk, but probably the single risk to our safety is the condition of the airstrips out there, and so we're continually seeking ways to work with the communities, work with the government, both nationally and regionally, to see how we can get them fixed up a little bit.
Do you have interpreters then? You've
always wondered about it. Oh, I should have said, there's a trade language called Tok Pisin, Pidgin English, and so that is the sort of common language. Within Papua New Guinea, English is still the language of the educated and the business world, but Tok Pisin is the one that's generally used around the bush. And so that's what I would use as a pilot. Nikki, as I'll say later on, does a lot of teaching of it for new staff. So, no, we don't have to learn 860 languages. And a lot of those languages are completely unrelated to each other. It's a fascinating subject. Nikki said that if she lived her life again, she'd come back as a linguist. Just to give you some idea of the sorts of people that we carry and the sorts of loads that we carry. Tom and Salome Hoey came to Papua New Guinea in the 1960s. Two of their sons have flown with MAF. Tom, now in his 80s, and Salome will actually be going back to Papua New Guinea tomorrow. They still keep on coming back to their beloved Bidarmani people. If you receive the MAF mailings, there's an article about them in the latest flyer. Quite remarkable people. They came into the area where they've worked for all those years at a time when the local people went for fresh meat. It meant a raid on the neighbouring village, and it wasn't to get any livestock, it was to get the people. They were still eating people out there. And so Tom and Salome have built about 5 airstrips, and their latest job has been to set up a new health centre right out, miles from anywhere. All of that building MAF flew in. We flew that in, except some of the local wood which Tom milled locally. Quite remarkable people. They've seen literally thousands of people come to Christ through their ministry in the area. And if you ask Tom how much would have been possible without MAF, he would say just a fraction. They'd have been able to do a bit, but not very much. And so most of the expat missionaries now have gone and handed over to the local church, but that's only been possible because MAF has been there to carry them around and to carry supplies in. We do a lot of work now for the National Church. Harder for the National Church because they generally don't have the financial resources behind them. But the person second from the left, Pastor Gabriel, is the Director of Ministries for the Baptist Union of Papua New Guinea. I flew him into a very remote little place called Yambaitok. He stayed there for a couple of weeks, training the local pastors, encouraging the church, teaching and being with them, and then we went in to fly him out. That is a big top, Papua New Guinea style. They call it a house sale. And people walk for days for this big event. It was combined with the opening of a local health centre. The church was a little bit in the doldrums, and the church leaders really wanted to give a kick and call people back to their first love. And we had a wonderful time out there. I was out there for a weekend, and people came in, and they were singing and dancing, and literally stuck up in the clouds, right on the side of a mountain. So how many people here would walk for 4 days to New Wine or Spring Harvest or something? It's something that they do over there. Health, we do a lot of work for health. This is a rural hospital run by a friend of ours, David Mills. And David has sought funding and got resourcing for building really quite a comprehensive hospital now. But just to give you an idea of the struggles that they face, internal politics can be very severe and often related to national politics. And in order to campaign, people like to get hold of money from any source. And David wouldn't let somebody on his staff get hold of some of the hospital money. And in short, he had to leave the hospital and go back to Australia for the best part of a year. During that time, all his nurses left, went elsewhere, and so he came back only a few months ago to find a staff that were there very depleted and very demoralised. So despite having some very good facilities, he's now having to rebuild the whole of the staff. Making good progress, but it shows just how vulnerable a country like Papua New Guinea is to the vagaries of dishonesty and local politics. But we do a lot of work for David. Medical supplies. You take it for granted to go down to the local pharmacy and there'll be lots of supplies there. We fly around about 800 tons of medical supplies into remote communities every year. If we didn't do it to a lot of these communities, they simply wouldn't get any medicines. And there is a well-stocked pharmacy, bush Papua New Guinea style. Just literally a few pots stuck on a shelf. If you go down to Lloyd's or Boots, their pharmacy anywhere in this country would look fuller than that and be fuller than that. Each year we probably save somewhere around about 500 or 600 lives of most commonly women in childbirth, but also people have had accidents, have been chopping down a tree and the tree's fallen on them, sometimes tribal fights with slash wounds and things like that. But around about 500 to 600 people each year owe their lives to MAF in Papua New Guinea. This is just Papua New Guinea, multiply that around the world and it's a phenomenal number of people being physically saved. Education, that's a classroom for the first stage of schooling in a rural PNG village. The next stage up, that is the entire equipment they have to teach their children with. No electronic whiteboards, no iPads, well, they don't even have electricity. So chalk, probably exercise books. They would be fortunate. They may or may not have exercise books. Just occasionally we fly school upgrade equipment and exercise books in, and it's actually quite salutary. You get into some of these villages and the kids are really enthusiastic to see school benches and school exercise books arriving. They really, in some places, not all, are really pleased to see it. And again, you sort of come back here and it's not cool to do well, particularly for boys in school and that sort of thing. Over there, there are kids who are delighted to see these things arrive. This was actually part of an EU-funded project to upgrade rural schools. Community development, we'll supply fly-in building supplies, equipment. We take out cash crops, that's a coffee bag, 50 kilos of raw coffee bean. Papua New Guinea supplies excellent coffee. I've turned into a coffee snob since I've been out there. I try very hard not to drink instant coffee. I only drink it if somebody doesn't tell me that's what it is, and I say unthinkingly, do you brew coffee? If they say yes, I'll say I have a coffee. If I say no, I'll say I'll have a cup of tea instead, thank you. But we do fly quite a lot of this out, and that provides the only cash crop for a lot of island communities. If they don't have that, they can't pay for school fees, they can't pay for health, buying medicines, they can't go out for church meetings and training and things like that. And projects such as this is a water project, bringing fresh water. Despite all the rain, fresh water's very often in short supply. My job, primarily a pilot. I do a lot of training now. As usual, if you're in a job long enough, you get asked to train other people. I do flight examination for the regulatory authority, the equivalent of the CAA out there. So if somebody needs an instrument rating, I can do their flight test. And a new role for me, I've been previously in charge of training. I'm going to actually be managing our flight operations when I go back at the beginning of November. Nikki, apart from pushing me out of the door every morning, which she's done very well for over 34 years now, she provides training for our new staff, the cultural orientation, the top pisin. Which we try to keep reasonably update. It looks like that. So that's a little bit. Just quickly, any questions? That's an overview of what we are involved in. But the fundamental thing is isolated people physically and spiritually transformed. And so that's what the missionaries have been doing, supported by MAF. It's what the church continues to do through MAF. It's what the development projects, be they church, NGO or government funded, like the UN School Upgrade Project, do through MAF. And it's one of the most exciting MAF programs, really, because we can actually say that through the ministry of MAF, a nation has been changed. And that has actually been recognised by the government on odd occasions. Where they've actually said thank you, we do appreciate what you're doing, and then the government changes and they forget about it again. But it is nice when they do say thank you.
Do they support you at
all? Not regularly. We did recently receive some money for it. We've been asking them for a tax break to get tax relief because VAT on things like fuel and aircraft parts is a big part of our budget. We haven't managed to get that one through. But there was somebody who thought kindly of us recently and did give us a fairly large cash amount, which has helped us very much with an upgrade program on some of our aircraft. So, but that was an exception.
We nominated a corporate citizen, which helps us at the moment. We've worked on it 5 years.
Yes, which is will be a big help. Yes. So MAF SIL, which is the operating arm of Wycliffe, and New Tribes Mission, will acknowledged as being good corporate citizens, so we had an advantage given to us in supposedly processing our visas and work permits more quickly. It went well to start with, it's slowed down a bit now, but we're hoping we'll be able to push that one for the future. We've got 19 pilots, and I can't remember, it's about 30 I think we've got out there at the moment, expat staff, and over 100 national staff. Over to you, Jeff. Oh, sorry, one more question. Traditionally, it's animistic belief in... Their concept of the world is very much that there's a visible and an invisible, but that's all part of the physical world. And so they would believe in spirits, the effect of ancestors on what they do now. And yes, the sort of spirits of trees, evil spirits certainly. So a lot of fear and sorcery built into that. It's a fairly typical animistic belief system. Yes, Christianity is a layer on top, which I'll give you some examples of where it's gone deeper later.